Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 202 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us, please go to caropop.com. Our guest this week is a legendary rock publicist with great stories to tell, Bob Merlis. I first got to know Merlis when I was writing about music for the Chicago Tribune and other outlets many years ago, when he was in the midst of his almost 30 years at Warner Brothers. He spent much of that time running the label's publicity department, when Warner Brothers was home to some of the greatest and most popular acts in music. Merlis dove into the rock world as a Columbia University student in the late 60s, presenting concerts by such acts as The Byrds, Martha and the Vandellas, and previous Caro Pop guest Mitch Ryder. Merlis worked in journalism as well. Hang on for his laugh-out-loud anecdote about the Carpenters. Then he saw the light and moved to the publicity side. For 29 years, with short interludes at Bearsville and RCA, Merlis was at Warner Brothers, winding up as Vice President of Worldwide Corporate Communications. But let him spin his own stories, which star Little Richard, Dion DiMucci, ZZ Top, Debbie Gibson, Chris Isaak, Talking Heads, Devo, the B-52s, the Bodines, Madonna, REM, and more. Which of these acts was the beneficiary of what he calls the cheapest promo in the history of Warner Brothers? Who wanted him punched out for a publicity suggestion? Who is especially nice and cool? Since leaving Warner Brothers in 2001, Bob Merlis has been running his own PR and consulting firm, MFH, which stands for Merlis for Hire. What valuable advice did Chris Isaak give him? What role did late Rolling Stones, Beatles manager Alan Klein, and Sam Cooke play in his latest act? There's much more, so let's get into it. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Bob Merlis. What's new in the business these days for you?
I'm the last person to ask what's new in the business. What's old in the business is what you should ask me, because I'm involved with the Jimi Hendrix catalog, as I have been for the last 23-24 years. And there's a new super duper box set, 6 LPs, 4 CDs, a Blu-ray of Axis Bold as Love, which is, you know, the most fully realized individual Jimi Hendrix record for my money, which is free, obviously.
There you go.
And I was sad to have missed the Songwriters Hall of Fame induction for Burt Burns, because I worked on the movie Bang the Burt Burns Story. And I'm very intimately aware of all the machinations of the Burt Burns world. And Joel Selvin's a great friend of mine, and he wrote the book about Burt Burns, and that was the basis for the narration of the film.
Are you still involved with the Sam Cooke estate as well?
I am, insofar as we represent Abco Music and Records, and they have the Sam Cooke catalog. There's a children's book based on A Change Is Going to Come that's supposed to come out, I think, in October. So they had to license the lyrics and so on. Really high-end, award-winning children's illustrator put it together. But don't make me say his name, because I'd have to look it up.
So representing Abco, does that mean that you're involved with those Rolling Stones boxes that they keep putting out?
Absolutely, yeah. Anything, you know, before 1971 is Abco.
Right.
And what I do is, when the Stones go out on tour, I literally keep score. I look at the set list each night and see what songs they did. And even after all this time, you usually have more than half from the Abco era.
Right. Ends with Let It Bleed. So, like, half of the classic four, the first half are Abco, which are Beggar's Banquet, the way a lot of people see it, Beggar's Banquet, Let It Bleed, and then you got Sticky Fingers and Exile. But really, Abco has most of the great stuff.
Yeah, and it's funny, I saw this movie about a guy in Japan who cleans toilets, a Wim Wenders film called A Perfect Day.
Right.
Perfect Days, and it uses the Lou Reed song, but it also uses... House of the Rising Sun, which is Abco, and it uses a track from Metamorphosis. And while it was playing, I went, I love this. What is it? It didn't spring right to mind. I had to Shazam it while the movie was running.
Well, one of my indulgences, which I've been prone to, when you could just order vinyl and records and things off online, was that when the Rolling Stones in mono box came back available in colored vinyl when it had been available in black vinyl a while ago, I ordered it through ABCO, through the website, and I got number 000003. So I'm like, Charlie Watts was still alive at that point. I'm like, this is like Charlie's copy because it was number three. And I figured, yeah, you know, Mick and Keith get one and two. I mean, they probably each have like the first edition of it anyway. But I just thought, well, that's kind of cool. That's like the lowest number for anything I've ever gotten. So plus the music's not bad.
Yeah, you might say. I listen to Flowers all the time. It's not a real album. I mean, it's sort of a cobbled together record, but I just love it so much. And also, it's come back into my consciousness, mostly provoked by Steven Van Zandt. Their Satanic Majesties, much better than it's given credit for being. Really interesting record.
It's really cool. I mean, the thing is, you just have like some really long, indulgent stuff that makes you go, "Oh, what are they doing?" And then you get this amazing stuff as well. And it's own thing. Like it has the rep for being them kind of, you know, copying Sgt. Pepper, but it's really not. It's really just like going off on this totally other.
It really doesn't have any of that music hall element that Sgt. Pepper does. Whereas Between the Buttons does. Something Happened to Me Yesterday.
Absolutely.
You know, tubas or sousaphones, that kind of thing.
Between the Buttons is an odd record. It's really cool, but it kind of slides in there. Like people think of like Aftermath and, you know, Saint, but Between the Buttons has a lot of great stuff on it, but it's kind of subdued. It's almost like their Kinks record.
Well put. Yeah. I hear exactly what you're saying. So.
Well, so, anyway. So what was, I mean, not that this is like a natural starting point, but Alan Klein calls you up. You've just left Warner Brothers. You're going to start working on ABCO stuff. Like he sort of was a legend looming large by the time you talked to him.
I already knew him, though. I knew him through mutual friends, including Peter Guralnick, Greg Keller. And I used to, even when I was still at Warner Brothers, the day of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductions, I never missed one for a long time. He would take everybody out to lunch, and it was kind of his Alan Salon. And I went to all of his parties after the inductions, and he actually put an ice pack on my head once. I have a picture of it. And so after Warner Brothers and I parted ways, the phone rang, and it was someone in Alan's office, and Mr. Klein thinks you're the perfect person to handle a new Sam Cooke album, Keep Moving On, which is sort of, you know, things that, many of which had already been released, but there was new material too, including the title song. I said, "Really?" And I thought, "I'm going to make it," you know, because that's it. That's the highest thing to which you can aspire is to have anything at all to do with Sam Cooke.
Right. And you've just left Warner Brothers and all these artists, and you're like, "Oh, well, Sam Cooke's not a bad place to start."
Yeah. I mean, when I was on my way out at Warner Brothers, I was in Vancouver. I was there where Chris Isaak was filming his TV show that ended up on Showtime. He took me aside. He said, "You know, if you don't get right back into it, they're going to forget you." I went, "But like, shocking. You know, I thought I would take some time off." He said, "No, they're going to forget you. This is what he works by. That's why he works so much and puts out a lot of records, because he doesn't want to be forgotten."
Now, do you think that was really good advice? Like, do you think that was actually true?
I took it. I don't know what to tell you. I had every intention of taking it, though, of doing something like that. I wasn't going to just wait, you know, sit around at home and wait for the phone to ring. I established a PR firm insofar as I got business cards printed, and did you know, as soon as I could. My first client was not ABCO. It was Deborah Gibson. Hmm. Thanks to Patty Conti at Atlantic. She said, "Oh, her mom is looking for somebody, and you know, maybe you should do this." And I had loved, not a guilty pleasure, just a I love Shake Your Love so much. Cody Mundy and I used to, like, we met each other at the Debbie Gibson concert, and, you know, it was sort of Arrested Development kind of thing. She's very talented, by the way. Anyway, I worked for Debbie Gibson for a few months, and then her mother called me and said, "I don't think you're worth it." And she,
what?
And she fired me.
You got fired by Debbie Gibson's mom?
Yeah, thanks. And that was a cautionary note that I took to heart thereafter, which is probably not a good idea to have clients who are managed by a parent. Everything is personal, or a spouse, wife
Right.
and, or husbandinger. I don't know how to say
There are a
that.
lot of those Spinal Tap-like stories of like the wife or this, the spouse who gets involved and alienates one member and, wants
But
them
I
to wear
command, but
unicorn costumes or whatever.
so I had these like rules that I try to adhere to. No spouse, no if the record has been out a long time and they want you to revive it, you're not gonna be able to raise the Titanic, most likely. And third, if they talk shit about the previous publicist, your name will go into that place in the future. And once I got a call from a woman, I guess I can't say it. I guess her husband is still active. I want to do the Jamaican accent so bad. But anyway, I'm not going to do it. And she told me that the previous publicist was terrible, and he couldn't even get him on the quote Jay Leno show. Like, really? That would be very difficult for an artist at this level. And I said, when's the album coming out? Or she says, oh, it's been out for several months. Like, check, 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 or
Right.
X, X. And that was, and once I said what I just said to you, to Wendy Goldstein, who was Delbert McClinton's manager, his wife. And she said, don't, I'm not going to be a pain in the ass. If you think I am, just tell me. And she was terrific. So, I'm glad I had those guardrails. So even if I could violate my own policy, I could, do that where the client was kind of aware of what my parameters were.
Well, I want to go back to your adventures in music journalism and also just presenting shows as a student, but to
Sure.
keep it in the present right now, how much of what you or other, music publicists, major publicists are promoting, how much of it is like new bands as opposed to that catalog of stuff like the Jimi Hendrix Project or Sam Cooke or something like that? Because I get like a lot of stuff about reissues and the new Wings thing and the new this and the that. That seems like it's a pretty major market now in a way that maybe it wasn't when you started.
Well, it is for me, and I think it's a function of my personal demographic. So I relate to that kind of music, music that came from the era of physical media. So maybe I'm typecast in that regard. And the truth is that new bands promote themselves through social media and so on. So maybe they can do it, or at least get a leg up before they have to go to the point where they hire an established publicist. So I don't have any brilliant insight there, because the stuff I handle now is catalogs and artists who are veteran, to say the least. I mean, Dion has been a client for about 40 years, and ZZ Top I go back with to I think DeGueo. I mean, we had an interruption when they left Warner Brothers, went to RCA, but they kept calling me even while they were on RCA. I have this relationship with them that I've had for so long, and it's great. I mean, it's like these people I know, they're my friends, they're almost family. All my kids grew up with ZZ Top. I have a picture of my son Ben, who's in his mid-40s now. He's about 13 maybe, or 14, and here he is at the Radio and Records Convention at the sound check for ZZ Top, and they gave him a Billy gave him a guitar, and Dusty and Frank backed him up, and he did a song all the way through, not for an audience, but he did it. He had the ZZ Top rhythm section for that one song. It was
Nice.
kind of great.
So when Rhino has puts out two box sets of ZZ Top reissues as their Rhino High Fidelity vinyl things, do you work on that with Rhino or is that a separate thing?
It's pretty much a separate thing. They do what they do. I think they're assured that they're going to sell out. It's very limited production, so they're not that interested in tub thumping to generate sales, because it's they have in mind what they can sell, and they go for it. Speaking
Yeah.
of veteran acts that I've had something to do with in recent times, the Cowsills, which is
Oh, there you
amazing.
go.
amazing to me. Not currently, but I had the last album, and here's an anecdote I like to tell. I went to the Happy Together tour, and to see them, and also because Jay and the Americans were there, and Jay and the Americans are from Brooklyn, and I have a whole thing about them. And so after the show, I see Bob Cousill through an L-shaped room. I can only see him. I don't see what's to the left. He said, "What'd you think?" I said, "Oh, you guys are great. And Jay and the new Jay is fantastic." You know, anybody who's in Jay and who sings, the lead singer of Jay and the Americans is by definition Jay. And like all of Tommy James's band, that's they're the Shondells always. So I said, "The new Jay is fantastic." And then the new Jay steps out from behind the blind of the wall there and says, "I'm the new Jay. I've been with them for 18 years." I said, "Well, new me, what can I tell you?"
Yeah, no, I've had Susan Cousill and John Cousill and Vicki Peterson talking about the Continental Drifters too. So
Yeah, I mean that was our
then
project.
you were pretty steeped in music before you started doing this.
I mean, as a kid, I mean, all my personal pursuits have never varied since I was like 5 or 6 years old. Like cats, cars, and rock and roll.
Oh,
Those.
I had a cat on my lap, but she left right before you called. What was the first record you bought with your own money?
Well, that's a good one. I always tell the story. The first record I got was Tweedledee D by Laverne Baker. Speaking of Chicago, my father gave that to me, and he put it on, and he ran around the house shaking his finger like Kay Kaiser would do, like a big ba or Cab Calloway might do. And I love that record so much. But I didn't buy it. He gave it to me. He thought I would like it. He was absolutely right. It might have been. I don't know. It might have been Jailhouse Rock, but I think I had records before then. In the olden days, you could buy a 45 or a 78 for the same price. And like a dumb kid, I thought it's bigger, it must be better, and you don't have to put the thing in the middle. Of course, most of them broke. I do have Carl Perkins' Blue Suede Shoes on a 78. I don't think it's worth that much because it was a hit. So, you know, if the record collectors are like inverse, you know,
Is it in
if
good
that
shape though?
about it must be worth a lot.
Yeah. Does it sound good? I mean, is it all?
It's not bad. Well, 78s are kind of, don't sound that good. Anyway, my Jailhouse Rock story is, and it's in this book called Record Store Days by Phil Gallo. Where I go to the record store, high grade electric. They sold washing machines and television sets, and they had a big display of the hits, you know, when you could pick them by number, which was good because if it was a sappy title, you didn't want to say, you know, I love you. You can just say number seven or whatever it was. Anyway, I wanted Jailhouse Rock and Don't Be Cruel. Do you get two for one? Picture sleeve, but they were sold out. So they said, "Give us the money, the 72 9 cents or whatever it was, and come back next week and get it." And I went, I didn't understand this process. You know, when you're seven, it's a little much. And so I had a piece of paper for my 79 cents, which I carried around. I didn't have a wallet, you know, I just had coins. So I just carried it around. And the next Saturday, I went there and I got my record. So this was a great lesson in deferred gratification.
There you go. And when you, what was the point where you realized, A, you wanted to do something with music professionally, and B, that it was actually realistic to do that?
I guess when I got to, even in high school, I didn't know you could do things in music. But when I was in high school, I went to a boarding school, and one room on each corridor was designated the radio room. Nobody could have, you couldn't even have a transistor radio. I mean, everyone snuck them in, but a record player, you couldn't ever fake that. And I had the radio room, and it was great. I mean, we just sat around and listened to records all the time. It's like, what could be better than that? Doing your homework, I suppose, but that's not important. I think when I was in college, I realized you could do it because I got involved in booking artists to come into our, you know, our facilities there. And the college, they didn't care that much, or at least I didn't. It wasn't expressed to me about making money. Breaking even was the goal. So You saw who you could book from different agencies, and then
So
plug
this
them
is,
in.
so you're at Columbia University in New York, right? So you're getting people coming to the big city, so that's an advantage at least.
Actually, there's a
Although there,
disadvantage.
but then there's competition from other places,
Yeah,
though.
you have a restriction. So if someone is playing a town hall the Fillmore was active then, there was a restriction, X miles away or, time delayed, etc. But we did okay. We had who'd we have? We had the Birds and the Barbarians, and that was good. And when the Birds came, it was like they didn't look like the Birds I knew, because it was Sweetheart of the Rodeo era, and
So it was, so Jim,
Graham played piano,
yeah.
so I didn't really know to expect that. I mean,
Wow.
it was great. They were able to do their hits. It was no problem. But I thought the Barbarians were hilarious because, Multi with the
Multi, right? Yeah.
and we had the opener was a band from Columbia University, Dada, and that included Rob Stoner, who went on to be Bob Dylan's musical director. He was then Rob Rothstein,
Wow.
one of my college roommates, in fact, ultimately. And so their singer had hair down to his waist, and Multi had hair down to his waist, and they borrowed each other's brush. That was like, whoa, this is like a hair down. It was pretty good.
So when you're booking these bands, were you starstruck by any of them? Which was like the first one that made you think,
You
oh my God, I can't
never
believe
really
I'm.
had much juxtaposition to them. They just showed up and they did what they did. Sometimes I got to introduce them on the microphone. That was kind of nerve-wracking, and I had no idea how to run roughshod over them. Like, what if they only do 20 minutes and walk away? I don't know what to do about that. But they all did more than adequate performances, and nobody groused about it that I remember.
But you weren't like in awe meeting Roger McGuinn and going, oh my God, it's Roger McGuinn. He did
Not
8 Miles
really. No,
High.
not really. Not really. I don't know why. I just thought, I kind of knew who these people were because of my record collection, and so I've seen some of them, or a percentage of them, at the Fillmore or other concert venues in New York and around the town. So, I don't think I ever had a moment where a Jackie Gleason humming a humming a humming a moment. I don't think I had one in those days.
Ever?
I met Jagger. This is a really good. I knew Keith's guitar tech, Pierre de Beauport. Sounds French, isn't? It's from Vermont, and see, he invited me to a show, to a sound check at the Wiltern Theater, smaller venue, and he parked me behind Charlie. Like, that was great because
Wow.
I could see the pleats in his trousers, and I could see they were of great quality. And he says to me during a break, "Have you ever met Mick Jagger?" I said, "No." He said, "Come here." He said, "Mick, this is Bob Merlis." And Mick says, "Pleased to meet you." Just like Sympathy for the Devil. How great is that? Well, what else is he going to say? He wrote the song. That's what he says. Pleased to
Right.
meet you.
So
That, I mean, it's a great moment. I wasn't like, I didn't
you didn't
melt.
go whoo woo.
I didn't melt into a puddle or anything.
Well, there you go.
I mean, I have my heroes. There's no question about it. But I don't know. I don't get all worked up about it. I see it all the time when people want to go up to a star. It's typically Billy Gibbons in my life, and tell them their life story and how much they mean to him, and like. Which is nice, but imagine this tens and hundreds of times a week. It's like, okay, I guess I'm groovy. I don't know what to tell you. What is it supposed to happens to Dion all the time. Dion gets more interview requests than anybody. And like, I'm 17 years old. I've heard Dion's music, my grandfather, whatever it is. There's always a lengthy story. And I know the hope is that this will get back to Dion. I know that.
I wrote a story for the Tribune. I'm trying to remember what it was. It might have been about sort of rockers continuing on and their, you know, later, you know, throughout their lives. And he sent me an email, like he'd seen the story and sent me an email. It's like, hey, it's Dion and I'm doing great and whatever. And I've been like looking for his email address. I'm like, oh, I need to have him on Carol Pop too, because he was so nice. You know, he was like super guy.
We'll get him on. He's got a new album coming out.
It would be great.
I'm a little awestruck by Dion because, you know, when I was a kid, he was the tough guy, was like somebody you really look up to. But I got to meet him so early on in my, you know, professional career that sort of faded away. But every now and then I think about it. I went to the Dion and the Belmonts reunion at Madison Square Garden, and these people ran around the top deck with a big banner. It must have taken 8 people to run with it. And it said, Brooklyn loves Dion. And I'm thinking, they speak for me, you know.
There you go.
I still say it all the time, like, come on, Brooklyn loves Dion.
and Little Richard, someone else you met early on, right?
Little Richard is like, that's the supernova. That's the be all and end all. That's ground zero for me. I was kind of awestruck by him because I thought about Little Richard so much, about like, all this is possible because of Little Richard. And what he did, nobody had ever done. If they did, we didn't know about it. And I got to meet him. And after a Rock and Roll Revival show, maybe, I don't know if it was the same one that Dion and the Belmonts were on, and I interviewed him for Record World, and he had a body makeup on, and like beautiful, pearls of sweat. It was just like he was art directed. And, I had a very standard interview. We're all flowers in God's beautiful bouquet, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, I got some juxtaposition to Dion, to Little Richard. And he continues to be pretty much, you know, the single most important person in rock and roll that I ever actually personally met. That, you know, it's like, that's ground zero. It's like, it can't not be overstated to me anyway. And there's so many others, but I did get chills. I went to the Play It Loud exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York about 4 years ago, and I saw Don and Phil's guitar together in a case, and I went, whoa.
How nice.
Nothing. It wouldn't have happened if this hadn't happened, you know?
You're in college and you're presenting these shows. Did you think then, you know, music journalism is going to be the way for me to pursue my love of music and to be close to the...
I didn't think it would be music journalism. I thought it would be journalism. And in fact, I went to journalism school at University of California in Berkeley after I graduated from Columbia. And I went there. I went to that city, but I never really attended school. I went to about 5 days of classes and realized I can't do this anymore. I have done this for, you know, how long is it when you go to high school and then college? Is that 16 years, right? No.
High school. Yeah, if you start with kindergarten, yeah, you know.
12 and 4.
So yeah, your 8th grade and then, you know, and then
yeah. So four like, and four. Hey, well, however long it was, I can't do it. Got to get a real job, which I was proved to be impossible to do. I couldn't do it. I tried to work for a car dealer. I went to the MG dealer there. I said, I know more about this than you do. They could care less with like a freak with giant hair trying to sell sports cars. And then I got a drive-away car with a friend of mine. We drove to Chicago. It was an Oldsmobile convertible, and we were told, don't put the top down. Like, damn. So anyway, we delivered the car, and I was in Chicago at my friend's parents' house. And I thought, I'll get a job here. So I went to Mercury Records, because they knew Mr. Steinberg. Those very close to him called him Mr. Steinberg, not the warmest guy in the world. You know, nothing panned out there. I heard the Pope worked for Mercury Records probably at that time. Did you know
that? I did not know that, no.
This came up in a call 2 days ago, that it is thought that the Pope had a summer job at Mercury Records.
Oh, that's my pitch. Pope, yeah. The Pope on Carol Pop to talk about that summer on Mercury Records and how it shaped us.
He was filing records. He put like this Na Na Hey Hey Kiss Him Goodbye in this slot, and he put Jerry Butler and Brenda Lee Eggers ain't understanding Mello in this spot. Well, we don't know what his job was
Wow.
or if he really had it, but I like to think he did.
So did you get that job in Mercury or no?
No. I continued to New York without the drive away car. I took a multi-million-dollar airplane instead of a, $4,000 car. And I did get a job just pounding the pavement. I just looked in the yellow pages or the white pages, like, here's Jubilee Records, here's Buddha Records, RCA, and I went to the three trades. I went to Billboard, Cashbox, and Record World, and I went to Record World, and they needed somebody. It's like, okay, I'll do this.
So when you're writing pieces about like the Stooges and Al Green and Todd Rundgren and Jerry Wexler, was that during this period or was that kind of spread out?
Well, Todd Rundgren hadn't happened yet, but I wrote about Swamp Dog and Gary Puckett and Kenny Rogers and the Carpenters. I have to tell you my Carpenters anecdote. It's great. And Richard remembers this. So they, Karen and Richard came up to the office, no bio, nothing. Here are the Carpenters, interview them, cold. I don't know who they are. I know that they have a record. They have Ticket to Ride, a cover of the Beatles song.
I remember them doing that. Was Close to You already out at this point then?
No album that I knew of. So they just like, okay, I'm talking to them. Where are you from? All this stuff. I said, how'd you get the name? I mean, what do you mean, how'd we get the name? Well, Carpenters. I thought maybe they were like, Christianly, Jesus was a Capricorn. His father was a carpenter. I don't know. And they said, it's our name. I said, now we're doing an Abbott and Costello thing. It's right. I know it's your name, but it's like, we're brother and sister. I didn't figure this out. I mean, they do look alike, but I didn't, I'm the dopey kid, I didn't. You don't tell me, I'm not going to just intuit it. And
you couldn't look this stuff up on the internet back then. You just had
no internet.
There's no press release that you were handed to like the bio.
No, nobody gave me a bio. Yeah. And the whole notion of bios came a little later in my tenure at Record World. Like, oh, there's this reference. This is handy. I don't have to ask half the questions. Anyway, so I saw Richard about 6 or 7 months ago. He invited the Avanti Club to come up and see his car collection. And there he was. And I talked to him about it. And he said, oh, you're not the only one to have done that back then.
That's very funny. So who was that article for? Was that Record World?
Record World, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I worked there for about 2 years or 2.5 years. And so basically anybody who came up to the office of note, not intended really, would they say, hey, talk to them. So I remember Kenny Rogers, and he said, how long is this going to take? I went, I don't know, as long as you want it to, because I have tickets to a matinee. Like, why are you here? care to do it. But I did meet Swamp Dog, who is my friend forever. We're in, not quite year 60, but getting there. And I talk to him all the time. I've never lost track of Swamp Dog. And he came up with Doris Duke. Do you know who this artist is? R&B artist, took her name from the Millionaires. Excellent. Here's the hit. To the other woman, I'm the other woman, and the other woman is his wife. Swamp Dog wrote that, which is great. Always great to write from the woman's point of view. So anyway, at Record World, you take Polaroid pictures of the people who came up, and they figure out how to glue them into the magazine. And Doris didn't like any of the pictures. She tore them up. It was like, geez, sorry, I don't know. I'm not hardly Karsh of Ottawa here. But anyway, we got over that. Anyway, Swamp Dog and I have been friends ever since. And I talked to him like 2 days ago.
Wow.
I recommend his movie. It's called Swamp Dog Has His Pool Painted. I'm in it.
Are you in the pool?
No, I'm in it. There's two historical, clips. One of which is we're on Little Art's poker party, Art Fine's, cable access show, and one is you see the cover of I'm not selling out, I'm buying in, and I'm there. All these sort of guys in suits are judging Swamp Dog. He's doing a literal tap dance on a conference table, and we're judging him. And I was sitting with my friend's wife, and I said, "That's me." She goes, "Who?" I said, "The guy in the left corner." She said, "What?" No recognition, not at all. But so this is a sad commentary on aging. But
did you have Swamp Dog as a client later?
Never had him as a client. I tried to sign him.
You tried to sign him to Warner Brothers?
I tried to sign him to RCA. I worked for RCA for about 6 months.
Oh, because that was your A&R stint.
My A&R thing. And I tried to sign him, and I couldn't. His wife chewed me out. "You know, if he was white, you'd do a whole album." I said, "Well, they want to buy this master." And the master was Ebony and Jet. You know the song?
Mm-mm.
"I got a lot accomplished, but I ain't done nothing yet till they write me up in Ebony and put my picture on the front of Jet." Genius. And ultimately, he sold it to Brut, the fragrance company, Fabergé. They had a record label. Who knew? So I never got to sign him. But I did sign a guy named Wallace Johnson, who was, I got through Alan Toussaint and Marshall Seahorn. I got to know them during my original Warner Brothers tenure. This is more than you need to know, but, and I said, they're the best producers there are. Let's find out what they have. So they had a record called Ooh Baby, I Miss You. The problem was Wallace had a lisp. So he'd say, "Ooh Baby, I Miss You Girl." It didn't bother me. We paid $500 for it. Did not go anywhere, but I bet it's collectible now.
The chronology is you're at Record World, and then what?
Then
was it Bearsville or?
No, I went to Warner Brothers.
Okay.
I went to Warner Brothers Records proper. You know, Bearsville was an affiliate, but came a little later. And I worked there for maybe 2 years.
So you're in New York still, or did you go to L.A.?
No.
Okay.
So
they're hiring you as like a publicist at Warner Brothers. You sort of made the thought, okay, I've been doing this Record World journalism thing enough. I want to go work for the people putting up the music.
That's the best record company. There's no question in my mind at that time. And it was confirmed later when I worked for another record company that wasn't very good, RCA. And I worked for Warner Brothers. Wasn't that fond of my boss, although she was nice enough to hire me, so that was good. And but then I got this job to work for Bearsville, which was cool, in the same building on a different floor with
Albert Grossman's label, right?
Yes. But you know, the guts of it were in New York, not in Woodstock. That's, they had a studio there and so on, and they probably did accounting and that kind of thing. So I worked for two guys I've known forever, one of whom just passed away, Paul Fishkin and Mark Nathan. And I had a terrific time, but I don't think I was growing there. And then RCA offered me a job to be an A&R man. I thought, well, this is what I was meant to do. I want to be, you know, Jerry Wexler. I want to sign people. I want to produce records. I have no idea how to do that, but, you know, it was a desire. I figured I'd work my way up. But that's when my third eye opened about how terrible RCA was as compared to Warner Brothers. I mean, they were kind of clueless. They had no direction. They just, it just seemed so scattered to me. I couldn't tell you. I know I'm looking a gift horse here, but anyway, it only lasted 6 months because they had a regime change and I was on the street. And then Warner Brothers hired me to write bios, and then they hired me to basically have my old job back.
Yeah, your bio says that you were at Warner Brothers for a cumulative 29 years with two timeouts, one at Bearsville Records, another at RCA, where you worked in the A&R department for an inglorious 6 months.
Yes,
That inglorious is a very specific word for you to throw in there. Inglorious?
You know, I was
it?
Trying to sign interesting acts, and my boss was Don Heckman. He was a jazz critic by trade, and he basically wanted to sign people so they could make records so he could play cornet on their records. I'm not making that up.
So who'd you want to sign that you couldn't sign?
I wanted to sign a band called The Planets that had a guy named Binky Phillips in them. in the band, who was like this guitar player, like on par with Pete Townshend, very much modeled on him, big chunky chord guy, and kind of cacophonous, but you know, maybe a great record producer could have, you know, melded them into something a little more coherent. I mean, I never really got around to much else. I did a compilation of, this was terrible, Mickey and Sylvia, because Sylvia had Pillow Talk at the time. So I said, you know, Sylvia's the original Love is Strange is on a Vic Records, RCA subsidiary.
Right. And Wings had just released that on Wildlife in 72 also. Their cover.
Well, Love is Strange. Yeah, yeah. We'll keep coming back. And so... like, okay, we'll do that. So the art direction says Mickey and Sylvia's greatest hits. You know, it's kind of lame. I mean, it's a compilation reissue kind of thing. Oh, I know. I had one called "The Wild Sound of New Orleans" by Al Toussaint. It's Alan Toussaint's first record. He didn't have a. It just ended S-A-N. I don't know why his name was spelled differently. And it had Java and Whipped Cream on it, an instrumental album. I thought, well, this is completely interesting because those became hits. He's obviously a hit songwriter. No vocals, so very limited appeal. And I said, well, I'd like to reissue this and do liner notes. And I think I interviewed Alan for the liner notes. And they said, well, we can't afford to set all this type. Well, it will make any sense if you don't explain what it is. So they put the kibosh on it. Ultimately, came out on Jake Riviera's label with not my liner notes. I don't think I even got around to it. But I did. I went to Miami to Criteria, where Alan was producing Dr. John's "Right Time, Wrong Place, Right Time," or the other way around. And I took a picture of him. And Warner Brothers bought it from me for $50 and put it on the back of the Southern Nights album. So I have a form of immortality there.
I have that album. So I'll have to go look at your, go check. Yeah. Do you have a photo credit on it?
Yeah, yeah. They mortised it out. So he's kind of like got ribbons of energy coming out of him.
Wow, that's great. So then you went back to Warner Brothers. New York.
Yes, and I was there for a couple of years. And then they asked me if I would be amenable to moving to Los Angeles, to Burbank, actually, where the home office was, and they would make me the director of publicity, and you know, I would be ennobled. So I did it.
And that was a good move, I assume it was, because you had a long career there.
The first year or two, I was like a little spooked by it. It seemed too easy. I can't explain it. The lifestyle, you know? And I thought, I'll do this for 2 years. It's like being in the army. And then I'll go back to New York where I belong. But by the time the 2 years that I had set as a goal in my mind, and I was, you know, established with the company and knew the workings of it and, you know, the people. And I got along with most of the, you know, the hierarchy there. I just revered Joe Smith so much. He was so funny. And he was the president. Mo Austin was the chairman. And I knew Joe. He'd come to the New York office and kibitz with people. Just, he was almost like a Borscht Belt guy, you know, not overt jokes, but funny stuff. He was a good friend of Don Rickles in real life. And then we were told, Joe is leaving. He's going to be the chairman or president of Elektra Records. And I said, bait and switch, Joe. I came here to be with you, and now you're going to Elektra. Because don't worry about it. And and later, you know, in more recent years, I got to work for him when he gave his collection of audio assets to the Library of Congress, and he got a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. So that was kind of great to reconnect with Joe and have fun with him yet again.
So when you're directing publicity for Warner Brothers, what is the, how much of the job is dealing with the people higher up? How much of the job is dealing with the publicist? How much of the job is coming up with strategies for each artist or each release? Like, how did it break down?
Yeah, I'd love to be able to say that it was like a scientific thing, but it wasn't.
Give me exact percentages.
Felt it out. You know, some are acts, you know, you just put a record out. You know, there's nothing to do. They don't tour. They're just, you know, I remember Ronnie Milsap had an album on Warner Brothers. I guess it was recorded in Memphis. Interesting record. But, you know, no one ever said, what have you done for Ronnie Millsap today? Like the answer is nothing. Well, I wrote his bio, so that's something. But you know, to be to beat the drum, to do overt publicity for people, you just kind of did it by the seat of your pants to some extent. But then I got into a rhythm, and then I had a staff, so we would assign them to do whatever they did, and they'd come back to me with reports about their progress or lack thereof. And it was, I wasn't cut out to be an administrator, but I ended up being one because, you know, I was the head of the department. So I have to give wise counsel to people when I didn't even give it to myself.
Which were the campaigns you oversaw where you thought, wow, we really broke this record, or we broke this artist?
Well, I'm very proud, but I don't think I will not take credit for breaking the artist. I'm very proud of the Talking Heads pencil and pen holder, pocket pen and pencil holder, the cheapest promo in the history of Warner Brothers. I think they cost a quarter a piece, but they were very cherché because you wanted that nerd look with the pencil holder and the top button buttoned. And, you know, I was I understood what that was about. Anti-style.
So was that early on, like Talking Head 77 sort of thing, or a little later?
It was early on. Yeah. Maybe the second album. And I mean, I went to see them as a three piece at Max's on a trip to New York, and went, oh, this is not like one of these things is not like the others. It's hard to say. I wish I would. If I had taken notes back then, I don't know how useful they'd be to recollect how we did what we did. I mean, I was very enthused about certain acts because they were breaking through, and I liked the music. Very helpful to like the music. If you don't like it, it's kind of, you got to fake it to some extent. I didn't like that very much.
So Devo was on Warner Brothers around.
Yeah, and I saw them before they were on Warner Brothers. I saw them in a little hall about a block and a half away from where I am right now, Larchmont Hall. It was, you went, go upstairs, and they showed the movie, and they did the Jocko Homo thing. It was like, whoa, what is this? I'd never been on this street before. Must have been very early in my tenure in Los Angeles, because this is not an unknown street, Larchmont Boulevard. And then we signed him. I mean, I said, I already know about this. You know, it was like, I am so ahead of the curve on this one. That was a big success in terms of, awareness. I mean, whether they sold a million records or 10, it was like everyone knew what this was, and it was not like other stuff. And speaking of Alan Toussaint, their version of Working in a Coal Mine, very good. I highly recommend the Devo documentary. It's great because
we just watched it like 2 weeks ago, like a week and a half ago.
They're not like, we want to be new wave. That we are speaking our own language to ourselves. We're an art collective. They could play. So they're way ahead of most art collectives in that regard. And just, you know, very, as original as you can be, because they lived in their own universe. They were not influenced by other stuff. To call them new wave is handy, but it really, they didn't identify with that.
Right. And they started before New Wave existed. I mean, they were doing what they were doing in like 74 or something like that, even though the first album didn't come out till 78.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think 78.
I liked them right away. I liked their left field, their, how twisted they were. But ultimately, they're very musical. So that's helpful. You know, if it sounds like noise, it's not going to be that compelling.
Right. And B-52s, they were Warner's also, like 79.
Yeah, I love them so much, but they were not nice to me.
Ah.
I said, I got a great idea. Chubby Checker was in town, and I said, how about if I bring Chubby to the Greek Theater, wherever they're playing, and we take pictures with him? And I think Kate said, why? I'm thinking, you have all these dances. Will you do all 16 dances? You know, he has 20 dances. You have 40 dances. You know, like, come on. It's a woman with a beehive hairdo and white go-go boots said, I don't understand that concept. Like, come on. Was she being disingenuous? I don't know. She's very nice. I've met her in later years. There was no issue. The Bodines, though, swore them off.
Which Bodine? Because they're two and they split from each other. So Kurt. So Kurt's the mean Bodine?
He's mean Bodine. Because I said, I got an idea. I'm terrible with these ideas. Max Baird Jr. is around. He's on the lot, whatever it was. Let's get him and have a picture taken with you. Like, why? I said, he played Jethro Bodine in the Beverly Hillbillies.
Oh.
Kurt said, whoever thinks that's a good idea should be punched in the face. Like, really? Okay, I'm out. That's it.
Wow.
You could say no thanks, like the B-52s, but should be punched in the face. And like, I thought, I don't have time for this.
Did you quit working with them at that point? Or
I wasn't their hands-on publicist. There was somebody else on the staff, so it wasn't like they missed me. But I just had animus towards them. It continues to this day. It really does, because it's just gratuitously mean. There's like, no thanks would be fine, or that's a little too high concept. Just like, you should be punched. That's not right.
What was the ratio of like the artists who were like nice people versus the artists who were pains in the butt?
I mean, Chris Isaak was somebody I just love working with. It was just joyful, always funny, you know, riffing with people. Didn't take it. He was a careerist, but he didn't take it seriously because he knew it's fun. It's rock and roll. It's like an Elvis movie. You know, like, look, here's instruments. We'll play them. You know, they could do that. I just like the vibe there so much. That's why, you know, it was discretionary for me in my last week at Warner Brothers. I went to Vancouver to work because I could get to hang out with Chris and Kenny and, you know, why not? You know who was very nice was Madonna. Very nice.
Oh, good.
I had a really good relationship with her. She was most important to me is if you're nice to my kids, that's the best.
When Warner Brothers was paying all that money to sign REM, did they involve you in that decision? Like, hey, we're gonna sign this band that we love, and you know, we got to come up with a way to break them even bigger.
I spent time with them, getting to know them. I think I like Peter to this moment. He's a great guy, you know, they just knew that I was a record guy. I knew about old records, and they were very excited about, oh, we can have access to the Rhino catalog. Ooh, you know, free records. Like, have an extra $2 million. You can buy as many records as you want. But, you know, they were at that level of reality, similar to mine. You know, it doesn't matter. If you get a free record, it's more valuable than one you paid for. I don't know about if that still holds, but and I spent time with them, went to their video shoots. Oh, I do have a great story about them now that I'm thinking of it. I went to Memphis. I was at some event in Nashville, and I went to Memphis on the way back and stopped off, and they were at Ardent. And I went to Ardent, and I met them, and I took them out to lunch. And they went to, I mean, you're in Memphis, and you're going to go to a health food restaurant. This is counterintuitive, but that's what Stipe wanted. So we went there, and they, you know, it's a cafeteria style. They put the food on. He goes, "That's too much. Take some back." Like, what? Take it back? Right.
But he was telling you to put food back?
No, he told the server, like, "That's, you're giving me too much food."
It's like, oh, okay.
Which is, you know, that's responsible. I kind of like that. But before I went to Ardent, I stopped off at Lansky's store on Beale Street, where you buy these notions like John the Conqueror and, you know, good luck charms and this kind of mojo stuff. And I gave everybody some talisman, including Scott Litt, the producer.
Right.
And flash forward X number of months, it's the Grammys. We're at the big Grammy party. They won a Grammy, I'm sure they won a Grammy. They certainly sold a lot of records. And Scott says, it worked. And I had no frame of reference because, you know, that stuff, that Lucky Mojo stuff, it worked. It's like, okay, I'll take full credit for, you know, having spent $2.50 on trinkets.
How much did your job change as sort of music delivery systems changed? As, you know, CDs became the thing, and, you know, I don't think you were still there when streaming was happening, but certainly.
I left in 2001.
Right.
So it was still physical stuff, but Napster was happening. That was a concern. I remember my boss said, "Why don't we just sell MP3s? People would buy them if they want it. It's better than stealing them." But he couldn't get the go ahead to do that. That was Russ Thayrett, actually. No, it was. I mean, we were there for the big changeover from LPs to CDs. That was a huge, upheaval in the industry, and everybody got to sell the same catalog again. And some of it was it wasn't right. I'm not an audiophile, so maybe I would know. I don't know, but see, when they jammed, "Oh, there's so much room on this. Let's put extra stuff on it." It kind of degrades it in a way. I can understand a second disc, but hearing things not in the right order, that's disconcerting sometimes.
Well, it definitely did something to the way people put out, artists, bands put out albums, and that they would be like, "Oh, we could just put out a 65-minute record instead of a 42-minute record." And the 42-minute records just tended to be better.
Question. You want to have them wanting more, not getting sick of it. But it seemed like the world of being self-indulgent was indulged, and you could do whatever you wanted for as long as you wanted.
Well, and you felt like, hey, this physical medium, there's all this extra room on it. So like, why
Might
not
as well
put
use it.
four bonus tracks on at the end of the record? And then you just have to tell people when you're listening to the record, that was actually the end of the record. These are the bonus songs. These aren't as good.
I mean, and I embraced it initially. I thought this is a great thing. I sold a lot of my LPs, and then I thought it's not fulfilling in some way. I mean, I liked it in the car. That was a good thing to have CDs in the car.
Sure.
And now I'm just buying back the same records I got rid of. Not all of them, but if it's $5 or under, I will buy it. And I've bought the same Roger Miller album three times. I'm sure of it, but it's still good.
So by the time you left Warner Brothers in 2001, and you'd been there since what, 72 off and on,
Yeah.
what were the biggest changes in the music industry?
Well, this whole corporatization. I never knew about budgets ever in the beginning, till about I was in Burbank for about 5 or 6 years, and like, "You're over budget." "I have a budget? I didn't even know that." I wasn't a profligate spender. I remember the man, who was it? It was Rod Stewart's manager said, "Well, we should have a big party and blah, blah, blah." I said, "I don't know if," he says, "What do you care? It's not your money." I thought, "Oh, I don't think that's responsible. Just because you asked for it doesn't mean you get it." But they all wanted to wheedle things out of me because they figured it comes with the lunch. We're on a big record company. You get a billboard, you get a party, all that stuff. Some of it is meaningful, some of it isn't.
So by the end, it was more budgets and constraints.
Yeah.
And
Oh,
did you have
corporate
to like
stuff.
run things? Did you have to run things higher up the ladder to do what you wanted to do at that point?
Not really. I mean, I was a skinflint, so I should have spent more. I could have flown first class, and I didn't. I felt bad about it, so I would fly coach. It's like, what a dope! Nobody would have chastised me for that. And then there's this whole corporate wars between the parent company and different factions. And I mean, I only cared about music, and then and all this hierarchy stuff. And I became the corporate communications guy, where it was more about executives than records. It's not that fulfilling for me, although I had my favorites. I was always on Moe's side, and if the people in New York were against him, I was against them. But it was like silly, and I think it was just like kind of this gratuitous displays of power and who's over who and stuff like that. It just does not speak to me, but I understand that if you're in the corporate life, that's super important to you.
So
I got it.
was it kind of time to go by the time you went, or like what happened?
Yeah, I mean, they had a big upheaval, and they were going to have anybody under, not under contract, they let my contract lapse, who was over 50 years old, who had been there for 10 years or more, was given an exit package. And I said, "Well, what if I don't take it?" Like, "Well, then you could be fired with none of these benefits." Like, "Oh, okay." I don't know. If I'd stayed, maybe, I don't know what would happen. It seemed unwise to do that.
Well, that's, and you know, after you've been there for so long, it's not like the nicest way to leave the company.
No, you know, I don't know what they could have done. They wanted to diminish overhead. Maybe they wanted to have a, you know, new blood. And my last job, there was a little bit of a sinecure because there was a head of Warner Publicity, a head of Reprise Publicity. This was explained to me. I said, so what does that make me? Chopped liver? Like, well, you can be corporate and you could pick a few acts. And like, okay, can I have something to do with Chris Isaac? I'll do that.
You know? So is that when you were the vice president of?
Worldwide Corporate Communications. My friend Greg Geller helped me devise this title. I said, I want a very portentous title. Maybe a fold-out business card, you know, and you know, it was sort of, then I got to do that stuff because of all this upheaval with the parent company, and, you know, it wasn't what I had signed up for, but, you know, I thought I did okay.
Did you enjoy those last years being vice president of all that?
Yeah, insofar as I still had juxtaposition of the music and a bunch of people that I liked. But by then, Mo Austin was gone. That was a huge blow. Because I used to think about this. I know this sounds so sick that when I was at Warner Brothers in California in the early years, I saw the stability that there was at Warner Brothers that you didn't see at most other companies. I mean, you know, even CBS, you know, it was like Clive Davis, then Walter Yetnikoff, then Tommy Mottola, and like Sigerson or whatever his name is, like, what happened? And with Warner Brothers, it was like, it's Mo and Mo's people. I was one of Mo's people. And I thought, I knew exactly how old he was all these years. I knew his birthday. And I thought, Mo's getting older. What if Mo dies? You know, like, I thought, our world will change. Well, it changed. He didn't die. He was shunted aside and did something else. But it was overwhelming to think about it because I cast my lot with him and his regime and his shock troops, so to speak, and Lenny Waronker, who I, you know, I talked to as recently as last week. You know, I just feel really close to him in many, many ways. But he's a real record producer. You know, he never knew what publicists did. He just was a smart guy.
He did all that Randy Newman stuff on top of everything else.
Which is the greatest. So funny. I spent a lot of funny time with Randy Newman. We were at a studio here on Melrose and summer day. He comes out, no shirt. It's a little flabby, you know? He goes, is it hot in here? Is it me? He was just like making believe he was coming on to me. It was so funny. I can't explain it, but...
Well, he was Warner. Was he on Reprise also? Mm-hmm. But yeah, I have all those
early on.
But I was, again, it's the sort of thing where, like, a major label backing those albums, it's hard to imagine someone like that getting that kind of support now.
Oh, and I remember very specifically when I was still in New York, we got a test pressing of Sail Away, and I played it. I sat in my boss's office and played it, and we laughed out loud. We said, we got to invite people over and play them a record. Yeah, I mean, big deal. You could just send them a record. And we had people come over and we had champagne and we played the record all the way through. And it's amazing that, you know, it held everybody's attention.
Could that happen today?
No point. Just put on headphones, listen to it yourself.
Yeah. Right. But even that, but like an album like that, even would that, would
I guess could, so that I've been in playbacks with Atmos where you have this optimal sound and, you know, it's a kind of reverent listening circumstance. I guess you could.
I mean, I saw that Rhino's doing I think it was a Rhino Reserve of Trouble in Paradise. Uh-huh. And a bunch of those have been re-released, but if there was like a new artist who was making the kind of satirical, beautiful music that Randy Newman is doing now, like, I wonder how far they would get and whether like a major label, you know, which are all kind of owned by the big corporations now, whether they would be too sort of risk averse to put out something like that.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, there were, you know, favorites of the company. It wasn't hard to divine who they were. Randy was clearly one of them. And he came to Philharmonic Hall before it was Avery Fisher Hall. His uncle Emil conducted a full orchestra. It's like, wow, this is amazing. Nobody could have made a dime on that, but somebody subsidized it. It's got to be Warner Brothers to emphasize, what an important artist and a singular artist. There's nobody does that. What is that? It's hard to describe it. It's not a singer-songwriter. He could creates a whole atmosphere. And it's so musical too. As a rock and roll fan, I didn't appreciate that kind of stuff, fully orchestrated things. It was like, as I mature, I get more, I'm open up to that kind of thing much more than I might have been. Strings, who needs it? Yes, you do. If you hear it, it's well done. It's like you can't beat it.
That's it for episode 202 of Caropop. Thanks so much to Bob Merlis for publicizing decades of excellent music and having such great stories to tell. To learn more about him and his firm, MFH, go to mfhpr.com. You can follow MFHPR on Facebook as well. Caropop is produced by Chris Swake. Thanks to all who support Caropop. If you'd like to throw something into the Caropop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. And I'll give you a shout out on the next episode. You can give $24 or whatever you like at caropop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caropop on the so-called socials at CaroPopcast. And you can follow me as well at Mark Caro at M-A-R-K-C-A-R-O. Please share this episode, subscribe here and on YouTube. Tell your friends and tune in again next week for another Caropop conversation. Thanks.